San Antonio, it's episode number 206 of the award-winning Midday with Trey and BK. In hour one, at 10:50, we speak with Illinois head coach Brad Underwood. At 10:30, the mass exodus continues from the Longhorn basketball team. Will roster mismanagement lead to Shaka Smart's downfall in Austin? And joining us mere minutes, it is Clark Kellogg. He is CBS college basketball analyst, one of the lead analysts over there, as well as other things. And he's been doing this whole Final Four gig for a long time now. We'll talk with him about that and more. I'm Trey Elling behind the glass, back in the studios, the Horns fantasy sports expert and one-time gigolo, Adam Wagner. What's up, Wags?
What's up, boys?
And the one you want to see of Gentiles here at the Horn with the fastest cattle prod this side of Dirty Sixth, he is Brad Kellner.
Everybody on? Good. Great. Grand. Wonderful.
The worst offender of the scent is Bob Cole over at Coke FM with the cool water. I mean, that dude, I swear he runs through a bottle a week.
No yelling on the bus!
Cool water cologne. Oh, BK, man. How we doing today?
Doing well. I'm just watching Clark Kellogg's expression right now as he listened to that intro, probably trying to figure out what the hell's going on.
Not at all.
Clark, are you familiar with the Cool Water cologne? Have you ever been aware of Cool Water?
Oh, I'm aware of the brand.
Okay.
I've not actually used it personally, but I'm aware of it.
Well, that's good to know, because there's one of our co-workers back in Austin who just, I swear,
loves Cool Water.
Oh, he douses a bottle on each day.
Well, a bottle's probably a little much, isn't it, BK?
it's a lot
I would say you should want to sprinkle rather than splash.
Yes, sir. Clark, how you doing, man?
I'm great. Absolutely fantastic. The important people and things are in good order in my circle. And obviously the Final Four is the Final Four, one of the best sporting events on the calendar.
And you've been covering the Final Four now for more than two decades, correct?
Yeah, this is my 22nd, either actually being on the court calling the games with Jim Nance or in the studio with Greg Gumbel. And now for the last 8 years, Turner has been our partner with CBS for the tournament. And I've been 5 years in the studio with Greg Gumbel and EJ and Kenny Smith and Charles Barkley. So, yeah, I've been at it for a while.
Do you prefer covering it in studio or actually being courtside calling the games?
You know, I love both. And okay. I'm fortunate that I've had the opportunity and privilege to do both during my tenure at CBS. And when you talk about the tournament, being able to get a sense of all that's going on from the studio would probably get the slight edge for me at this point. And I actually have the privilege of calling the games for Westwood One with Coach Thompson and Kevin Kugler. And this will be my fourth season, I think, doing that. So I get the best of all worlds when it comes to covering the tournament.
Absolutely. Now, Clark, you've been doing this for 22 years, as you said. Is there anything that surprises you at this point? Anything that you see each and every year that's new, or is it all kind of a routine for
you? You know what, BK? I've established a routine of preparation. I actually get excited once the season starts, and then it ramps up incrementally as we go through conference play. And then the conference tournament week prior to Selection Sunday, those 10 days prior to Selection Sunday, is probably my most enjoyable time because I get a chance to watch all of these other teams that maybe I haven't seen as much. And then we obviously get to the Field of 68. But the tournament is so unique in that it's the gift that always gives and keeps giving.
Yes, sir.
And you anticipate the surprises, the human interest stories, and we've had all of that and then some this year as well.
No doubt. And Clark, of course, you played at Ohio State back in the day. Was the tournament time
No, I'm a dinosaur in terms of my playing days, BK and Trey. It was the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. Had a chance to play in two NCAA tournaments in the 3 years that I was at Ohio State. We got to the Sweet 16 in 80 before the field had was expanded to the 64. And lost to a UCLA team that ended up going to the Final Four that year in 1980. 82, we were upset by James Madison in the first round. So, and then my sophomore year, we weren't eligible for postseason play. So, the tournament has grown exponentially since the expansion in 85 to 64 teams. And then we had another expansion 2011 to 68. And the magnitude of it with all of the social media platforms and coverage and talk radio, I mean, it's just it actually is one of the largest sporting events on the calendar. And for many people, it's the very best, the 3 weeks that March Madness is.
Are you still filling out a bracket in this point of the process?
Well, one of the things that we get the benefit of as commentators on television or radio is that we have to pick the teams who are actually still playing. So we do a bracket. I did one earlier, and it's shredded.
Shambles.
Because it's in shambles, just like everybody else's, because I had Michigan State winning it all. And those, but each week, we get a chance to talk about who we think will win and why. I've not gotten to that point yet with these four because we've got a few days yet, but I think we've got four evenly matched teams.
Well, Clark, we know you're busy, but we know people can find out later watching on CBS. We got to ask you, man. Yeah, we got to ask you if you had to pick right now since your Spartans
you
are
know
out
what?
Of this thing.
Yeah, you know what? It's really, I mean, Villanova's been very, very impressive. Explosive offensively, solid defensively. Michigan has been probably the most dominant defensive team remaining of the four. Kansas is starting to get play from its interior. And, well, Azubuike has been a finisher as long as he's been on the floor. He's been a great finisher all year. And now DeSosa is starting to give them some nice complimentary minutes as well. And then you look at the Loyola Ramblers, perhaps the most consistently efficient shooting team of all four when you talk about start to finish. So I'm still trying to decipher which direction I'm going to go in terms of my picks, but not ready to get there yet.
That is a beautiful brand of offense that the Loyola Ramblers run as well. You don't see a whole lot of that in college basketball these days. It's a whole lot more up and down. But to see the spacing and the passing and just the lack of over-dribbling is something nice to see in 2018.
I tell you what, you think about all four of these teams. They all have that element of beautiful play. Mm-hmm. Spacing the floor, four around one typically, so the ball is moving. Outstanding catch and shoot players. So all of those, all of these teams have elements of that, and Loyola being the team that's not of the same brand name as the other three perhaps is a little more surprising, but they've shown they belong.
No doubt. Clark, you're a wanted man, my friend, so we got to let you go.
Shot clock about to expire.
I'm telling you, man. But we appreciate the time, sir, and hopefully we'll see you the rest of the weekend. But,
well, BK, I hope you enjoy your first opportunity covering the Final Four, man. I'm excited for you. I can see your excitement.
Yes, sir.
So have a great time. It's a wonderful event to be part of.
Thanks a lot, Clark.
All right, Trey. Appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
There he goes. Clark Kellogg from CBS, CBS Sports. He'll be all over your TV waves over the next couple of days getting it done. Yeah, he's a wanted man, man. We appreciate the 10 minutes, but he's off to other shows. This is cool, Trey. I mean, we didn't get a chance to do much of an intro to kind of describe where we're at.
Whirlwind right into the process.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I had to get some Whataburger as you're messing with some controls.
Just turning the microphone down.
I don't know how to use
there.
Any of these things.
I know.
So I'm just not going to touch any of these buttons.
Up,
all this equipment is worth more than I am. So,
well, there were some questions of how many people would actually be here on this Thursday. And let me tell you, there's no concern about the people that we're going to get to speak with in person today. It started out with Clark Kellogg.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Brad Underwood at the end of this hour. Just stay tuned because we're not even totally sure who we're going to be speaking with over the next 3 hours now.
I'll tell you what, man. I parked the car. I had to get some Whataburger, you know, because I'm about to embark on an eight-day binge without bread. I don't know if you can call it a binge because there's no bread. 8 days without bread starting tomorrow night. So I'm getting as much fast food, as much breaded-like things as I can get. So I got a couple of potato, egg, and cheese taquitos in my backpack. But as I stop through Whataburger, I'm walking here to the convention center, kind of hustling to get here by 10, and I see Jim Calhoun and Frank Martin having a conversation just on the street.
How about that?
Just chill. I mean, Frank Martin's in just sweats and basketball shorts. Jim Calhoun's just rocking a top and khakis, just chilling. We saw Brad Underwood, who's going to join us at the bottom of the hour, just walking around here.
Top of the hour.
It is the top of the hour, whatever. I don't know how this works. It is the who's who of college basketball people around here, and we're excited to be a part of it. And, yes, it's no shortage of attendance here, despite it being 2 days away from the games. Pretty full crowd here at the Convention Center down in San Antonio.
Hey, you mentioned Passover starting tomorrow. Somebody slipped into my DMs yesterday and suggested...
Slid into your DMs.
Slid
into the DMs.
Okay.
They don't slip into nobody's DMs. That means you screwed up. They're sliding into the DMs.
Not totally sure what you young kids say, all the lingo and whatnot. But somebody suggested we do a bracket, because this is the year of doing random brackets that maybe have nothing to do with sports, a plagues bracket. In honor of Passover, so ranking all the different plagues and having them go up against one another. Do you maybe want to do that sometime in the next couple of days?
What, the 10 plagues or the 12 plagues?
I think it's 10, yeah.
I can't remember. I'll learn again tomorrow.
We'll maybe make up a couple of plagues, you know, like
right.
The bubonic plague, maybe the great herpes outbreak of the University of Texas while you were in school there.
Did that happen?
I don't know. Did it?
I hope not. No, not with me. I wasn't involved in that. That would be something. That's not a bad idea right there. But, no, it's going to be down in San Antonio. Look, it's opening day for baseball, so, of course, we'll talk a little bit of Rangers and Astros.
Didn't even think about that.
Look, opening day, there's no start to a season like opening day. I mean, especially this year when every team was scheduled to play. Now we have a couple of rainouts, mm-hmm. of course, but just something about going to the ballpark for the first time and, you know, the grass is green and the field looks perfect. The grounds crew's been getting it done. All the fans are excited. You've got the national anthem. I know the commissioner's going to be up in Arlington this year. at the Astros Rangers game.
Oh, because of the Astros. Certainly not because of the Rangers.
No, it's because he's getting the Rangers World Series 2019 parade started. And he's getting the ship off the ground.
2019. I like how you skipped a year because there's no way they're winning a World Series this year.
Shoot, it is 2018 still, isn't it? So he'll be up there. Of course, the Astros and Rangers will get it going at about 2:30. But, man, it's still college basketball season. I'll get into baseball next week, but we got the Final Four going on, a couple games on Saturday, and the championship on Monday. Then it'll be time to transition over to baseball.
When we talked about this earlier in the week, BK, you really didn't want to give an answer or a prediction of what you think might happen here in a couple of days here in San Antonio from the Alamo Dome. As a Kansas Jayhawks fan, where are you right now with Kansas Villanova, which I think is the matchup that those who love college basketball are looking forward to the most on Saturday night?
You know, I know the experts and analysts won't say something like this, but I think Villanova is unbeatable, and I'll go down with the Wildcat ship if that happens, if they do get knocked out by Kansas or either Michigan or Loyola. That team, when they play at their best, is the best team in the country by far. They've got everything that you want. They've got the experience, not only in years with a lot of upperclassmen on their team, but look, this is a Wildcats team that won the championship 2 years ago. They've played in football stadiums before, and they've been successful. They've got the National Player of the Year in Jalen Brunson. They've got depth. Mikal Bridges might be their most talented player. He gets it done on both ends of the floor. They've got a head coach who's been here in Jay Wright. Villanova's got it all. They've got everything you want, and when they're at their best, there's not a team in the country that can compete with them. You know, I always go back to their Elite Eight game against Texas Tech. Look, Texas Tech is a hell of a team. They held the Red Raiders to 33% shooting. And Villanova, Jay Wright after the game said, Chris Beard, Texas Tech, the best defensive team we've gone up against all year. And despite that, despite the fact that Villanova had its worst offensive output and they only shot 33%, they beat Texas Tech by double digits. So Villanova, if they play their basketball, their brand of basketball, they hit shots. They're the best free throw shooting team in the country. So if it becomes a close game,
they hit 12 down the stretch versus Tech.
They're nails at the charity stripe. I think they're the best team left in this thing, and I think come Monday night they will be cutting down the nets.
I have to let you and everybody else know that we have what I'm thinking is one final update in the Ketchup Gate saga from last weekend.
Oh, no.
It's gone on these airwaves all week long, not just with the midday show, also the afternoon shows and morning shows as well. Made the call to the wife last night.
Oh, so after the show.
That's right. I haven't even told people this yet, but after the show, called my buddy back. He actually did pick up the phone, had the conversation with him, still very raw about things. And he got a little bit of solace out of the fact that it provided all of you people entertainment on the airwaves, you, Wags, everybody else listening who responded on the text line yesterday.
Oh, it was awesome.
But he's still ticked off at me, and he said the only way that he'll even start to consider not being upset with me anymore was actually making a call to him last night to speak with his wife, because he's in a hole with his wife right now, so I have to help him get out of that hole. So I said, of course, I have no problem doing that. What I did was wrong. I apologize. I cannot apologize enough. There's no rationale for it. There's no excuses. I'm sorry. All of you guys have made me realize the error of my ways over the last 4 days now. And so there was no defending it anymore. And I just wanted to make sure that she was not only not angry with him, but not angry with me she's probably going to remain angry with me for a while, but for as long as possible.
Yeah, how did that conversation go?
I called her, apologized, and actually, I'm getting a little bit choked up talking about it right now. I shed tears.
Oh, man.
I that's how bad I feel about all this. She put Henry, the six-year-old, on the phone. I had to apologize to him, too.
Oh, dude, that was cringeworthy radio yesterday. And you weren't putting on a face or facade or something. You were actually, like, shaking in the studio. You hated all of that. And I enjoyed every second of it, but good on you. Good on you for making the call and hopefully writing things with them. What'd they say? What'd the kids say? I mean, the kid's been getting his you-know-what whooped over the past couple of days, getting soap put into his mouth because his parents thought he was lying about you offering to pay him $20 for squirting ketchup on his dad.
He said he actually still called me Uncle Trey, which, again, is one of those things that that causes you to shed tears, that even though you wronged a kid, that he still thinks that much of you. And at the end, Janina, which is Chris's wife, she said, thank you very much. We really appreciate it. But one of our mutual friends actually told us what happened later that night.
Oh.
So My friend came on these airwaves yesterday and jacked with me and made me feel worse about this.
That's
and made me
awesome.
Cry to his wife and kid.
No
and that's
way.
Why I paid his kid to squirt me with ketchup to begin with. I'm going to try not to yell right now.
That
I'm
is awesome.
A little bit ticked off about that. By the way, the kid's not getting the $20 right now.
Oh, are you serious?
He's
Come
not,
on.
He's not getting the $20.
Dude, the kid still got punished.
He earned it back
no
by making
way.
Me feel bad about
it.
They taught
gosh.
That kid to lie to me. And he lied to me last night, as did the rest of them all throughout the week. He came on and said that he washed his kid's mouth out with soap. He didn't
that
wash
didn't
his,
happen.
He didn't wash
oh.
his kid's mouth out with soap.
Dude, that is gold. God, why are all of your friends and siblings so much cooler than you are, man? That's incredible. That is incredible.
That's,
the whole thing was fake?
That's the
Coming on the air yesterday?
That's the relationship I have with this guy.
Dude, he did a phenomenal job because he had me fooled. He had everybody listening fooled.
He pulled a fast one on me yesterday, and that's why we have the relationship that we do. Unfortunately,
wow.
I don't think... I'm going to be sprayed with a condiment now because of it.
That is awesome. Well, you should still pay the kid $20 because he did get a potch in public. That actually did happen.
I probably
maybe
will
like
still.
Maybe like $10. Maybe like a little bit less.
I'll still pay the kid the $20, but
okay.
I'm certainly not upping it now. There's no spanking or mouth-watching tax that goes with the $20 now. He gets the $20,
Man.
And my buddy gets to take solace that he came on the airwaves and fooled me and everybody else into thinking
that, is awesome.
That he and his wife were having marital problems and he was washing his kid's mouth out with soap all week.
I'll tell you what. That is the perfect end to that story right there.
And I deserved it too.
Yeah. Well,
I can't be that upset with them because I deserved
well, glad,
it.
Glad y'all are still friends. Glad everything is okay. And that was a highly entertaining bit of radio. Very cringeworthy. I can imagine people just sitting in their car yesterday or sitting at work just silent. Just almost like jaw dropped listening to that segment. I was there. I was in between that and turning my mic off so I could like cry laughing, and then I'd go back to just jaw dropped as all that went down. That was top notch stuff right there.
Justine went back and listened, my wife, and said she was ashamed of me at the end of that interview.
She should have been. We're all ashamed of you all the time. That's why we're an award winning program right there.
Why don't we take a break right now, because we're not sure who's going to show up at this table over the next couple of hours. So it requires us to sign up at times for guests. So let's go ahead and hit the break at the end of the hour, 10:50, Brad Underwood will join the show. And again, there's a ton of people passing through this radio row over the next couple of days, including some high-round NBA draft picks or soon-to-be draft picks come June. DeAndre
nice.
Ayton is going to make an appearance at some point in the next couple of days.
On this show?
I don't know about on this show. I'm
oh,
going to try and
man.
Angle for that. But at some point, he will be here. And if not this show, maybe we'll get him on with either Rod or the afternoon guys.
Dude, my first words with him are going to be, why do you look like you're 40 years old? How does that happen? And then it'll be about how good he is at basketball and in the NBA draft. That was going to be the number one pick. But
yep.
There's a lot going on here. We are live from Radio Row Westwood 1. Radio Row down here in San Antonio, Texas, giving you all things Final Four. We'll be here today. We'll be here tomorrow. After the shows today, there's press conferences from a lot of these teams, so we'll get some audio for that. And having a good time down in the Alamo City here in San Antonio, Texas. We will be right back. You're listening to Midday with Trey and BK right here on the Horn.
Back here on Midday with Trey and BK, live from Westwood One's NCAA Final Four Radio Row, and it's brought to you by Cintas. More than 1 million businesses trust Cintas to help them open their doors with confidence. Learn how they can get your business ready at Cintas.com. That's Cintas.com, ready for the workday. And BK, we're joined now by a couple of guys who are Alamo historians.
Yeah.
Not Alamo Bowl historians, not Alamo Dome historians.
Alamo Draft House?
Not Alamo Draft House historians. The real deal, the Alamo, which every Texan who was born and bred in the state, and even some who weren't necessarily born and bred in the state, take immense pride in. It's Dr. Bruce Winders, also Tom Harper. Guys, thank you for joining us today.
Hi.
How you doing?
Thank you.
Very well, thanks.
We're doing good.
Cool. Tom, you told us before this official interview got going that you're actually from York, England originally.
That's right, yes.
What brought you to San Antonio, rather, and what has you so interested in the Alamo to the point where you actually called an office each and every day?
Well, what brought me here is actually the ring on my wedding ring finger.
Okay.
So I'm married to a Texan, but I'm a historian. I'm academically a historian, and my specialty is Roman history, but the history is it's a story of human endeavor, and this is just another chapter in it, and they're all good chapters. So,
Tom, I'd ask the outfit. Can you try to describe to our listeners listeners the garb that you are rocking
so
today.
So I'm actually wearing civilian clothes at the time. You kind of look at me like it should be a military dress. I'm wearing a tailcoat, high boots, a sash. The Texan Army didn't have time to get a uniform in the time the war was going on. As a result, this is civilian clothes. Yeah. It looks kind of military, but then you get guys walking around in camo these days.
No doubt about that. And Dr. Bruce Winders, are you from Texas originally?
Actually, I came down from Kentucky.
Down from Kentucky.
So I'm kind of a proto-Texan.
All right. But how long you been here for?
I've been in Texas since 78.
And when you came down in 78, how quickly did you realize how big of a deal the Alamo was here?
Well, I knew it was a big deal even before I came.
Okay.
Because I'm that generation of Fess Parker, John Wayne, mm-hmm. you know, remember the Alamo.
Right.
Got
no
to
doubt.
See it. So, yeah, it was. There are many people like me that, you know, they may not have come to Texas, you know, maybe their first time coming here, but, you know, they remember it.
Now, so, what got you so interested in studying and doing your research? You mentioned, of course, the Westerns and the John Waynes of the world, but why the Alamo? Why were you so drawn to this and learning so much about the Alamo?
At the time that I grew up, American history essentially was Star Wars. You know, it had that effect on kids. You know, they wanted to know about American historical figures, battles and things like that. That's what our movies were about. Mm-hmm. And some of them were, I'll have to admit, were pretty horrible. But they piqued our interest, and we wanted to know more. So Alamo was something that, you know, not just me, but a lot of boys and girls put on their coonskin caps and got their fake Bowie knives and played Alamo and then started reading about it. And then, you know, who knew that I'd ever be at the Alamo?
Whether
I probably didn't think he'd ever be at the Alamo either.
Yeah, well, the Alamo, the funny thing about walking around downtown is the Alamo is so unassuming, which I guess is fitting considering what that battle was. You mentioned that the people who fought there didn't necessarily have time to get dressed up as soldiers. They were essentially ambushed by Santa Anna's army. But when you walk by the Alamo today, it's amongst these tall buildings now, and then all of a sudden there's the Alamo right there. And maybe because you know the historical significance, you expect something maybe a little bit more grandiose. But it's a tiny little building. And what I guess I wanted to ask you is, when you moved here, you had notions, ideas about the Alamo from watching movies and reading about it. Was there maybe a common myth that was dispelled pretty quickly once you started looking into things?
Well, when I came here, I was pretty, you know, I was a historian, so I kind of knew some of the myths were not true.
Okay.
But it's actually been the time that I've been at the Alamo where I've been able to do research and go, you know, there's a different story here. And it's just as interesting as the myths and legends. That's what we need to tell visitors, the real history of the Alamo, as opposed to, again,
what is one of those big myths that you're trying to dispel whenever you're talking to people about it?
The idea, again, for people who, you know, were raised on John Wayne's movie, the idea was it's an abandoned mission in the middle of nowhere. And it never was abandoned. It always was put to some other use.
Hmm.
And so that's why you can go there today and there, the church is there, is because it was always useful for something. And they're not fighting over that church. They're not fighting over that mission compound. They're fighting over the town of San Antonio de Bejar. The rebels have captured it. Santa Ana, for the Mexican government, has come to recapture it. So that's what the battle's about.
And Tom, what about you? A similar question. Maybe there's a lot of people in the state of Texas who think they know just about everything about the Alamo.
Oh,
they know,
yes.
They know the background, at least the basics. But what is maybe a myth or something that people don't know and should about the history of the Alamo?
The one I like is the death of Jim Bowie. I mean, my specialty, working living historian, is the medicine of the 1830s. That's kind of the area I've gravitated towards and know a lot about. So if you have 5 minutes, I'll happily tell you about amputation without anesthetic. But with Jim Bowie, you get a lot of these myths about him taking down 6 or 7 men with his knife during the final fight. Most likely he was in the last stages of tuberculosis at the time. And that's a big myth. Does it make it any less dramatic? Absolutely not. But it's the reality of it. And sometimes people get a little bit upset when they have the Mills myths questioned, but it just changes the story. It doesn't make it any less important to learn.
We'll ask both you guys this question, starting with you, Tom. How close were those at the Alamo from being able to defeat Santa Anna's army, or was it just a matter of them being so outmatched it was never going to happen?
This was a last stand. Every culture has last stands. The British had things like Hastings and Rorke's Drift. Rorke's Drift was actually a last stand that they won because they had repeating rifles against men with spears. So unless you've got that kind of advantage, you're not going to win.
Yep. The it's a military battle. I was listening to his answer and lost the question. What was the question?
The question is, how close were those at the Alamo from actually being able to win that battle?
They weren't very close.
Okay.
And it's because, remember William Barrett Travis's letters that he's sending out? People are actually responding, and they're on their way. They just don't get here in time. So time was against them, mode of transportation. So, they were hanging on, but help didn't come.
What do you guys have going on at the Alamo nowadays? I mean, now it's kind of a tourist spot, but for people who live in Austin, we're right down the road maybe to promote the Alamo and try to get people down there.
Absolutely.
What's going on?
We have living historian encampments at the site 364 days of the year except Christmas Day, so there are always people in the grounds of the Alamo talking about the material culture of the 1830s. It's a really interesting part of it. You can see items, weapons, equipment of the time. And on weekends, we have things like firing demonstrations as well with the black powder muskets. And if you come on the first Saturday of each month, there's usually a much larger event. We have a group of volunteers coming in, and they help us with many more topics that we couldn't cover on our own.
Dr. Bruce Winders and Tom Harper joining us right now. They are experts on the Alamo. Yes, that Alamo, not the Alamo Dome, not the Alamo Bowl, not Alamo Rental Car, not the Alamo Draft House, the actual Alamo itself. Guys, do you still have people who provide you relics from the Alamo from that time? Do you still have people who maybe reach out to you and say, hey, this is a long-lost relative here, just found this, and I wanted to donate this to you guys so you could actually utilize it in the museum?
Yes, I can't say we have that happen all the time, but since I've been there, we've been approached by either family members or somebody who somehow acquired it, and they're going, this is bigger than me. I want other people to see that. One of the biggest examples is Phil Collins from Genesis. Who's
Phil Collins from Genesis?
Yeah.
Oh, he was in the made for TV movie with Alec Baldwin, right?
Oh, I don't know about that. But he grew up in fellow
Another
countrymen. Genesis, the band. He always, he was of that generation that saw John Wayne late in life. Said, I love the Alamo. I've got the money. I'm going to start collecting Alamo artifacts. And so he built a first-rate collection of Alamo and Texas Rev artifacts, and he gave them to the Alamo.
What was maybe the biggest or coolest of all the artifacts that he provided you guys?
We've got items that belong to Crockett. We've got items that belong to James Bowie. So he was able to actually find items that you can say, this was in the hands of somebody historic.
Tom, whenever he made that donation, could you actually feel it coming in the air tonight when he was about to make
absolutely.
The donation?
Okay. Absolutely.
All right. Good one. This is a very negligent question, I'll admit it, because I don't know much about being a historian or how you collect artifacts, but how do you prove? I mean, this happened in the 1830s, right?
Yeah.
How do you prove something if somebody just comes to you today? Says, hey, I've got this artifact from Bowie. How do you prove that that's true or that it's a real thing? What's the process for that?
It's hard, and it's important because you want to know that the artifact that you're telling somebody is actually what you're saying it is.
Sure.
But it's kind of like a chain of custody in a crime case. How close can you get it back to that person? Did it go to their family? Can you check family records that yes, this person had it, then this person had it. If it was an auction item, where did they get it? And so you really, it's a very important question. And it's something that sometimes what we want falls short. But sometimes folks, want to believe it's that, so they believe it's that.
Interesting. Last thing here for you guys. Tom, I got to ask you because you mentioned it a little bit earlier. What was amputation like in the mid-1800s without anesthetic?
It was as quick as possible. As okay. quick as possible. You're looking at...
lots of bleed outs?
Yeah. Survival rate, depending on where you're amputating, closer to the main torso, either up the leg or the arm, you're looking as low as a 20% survival rate.
Oh, wow.
So it had to be quick. The fastest surgeons, which was, as far as I know, a British doctor called Mr. Liston, he could amputate a man's leg in 23 seconds.
23 seconds?
Yep. Gun through the bone, straight to 23 seconds.
Wow.
Now, there's preparation that's going to take a little time, but yeah, the idea was this is going to hurt.
Yeah.
So we're going to get this over quick.
There you go.
No doubt about that.
Before you bleed to death.
Let's rip the Band-Aid off as well. And you said you started out as a Roman historian?
That's my master's degree is in Roman military history.
So we've heard a lot of comparisons to modern America to the olden Roman times in terms of excess leading to the demise of that empire. Do you see similarities there?
Well, that was actually... a snapshot of a certain period of Roman history. So we have Pompeii, which a lot of people have heard about, and that was frozen in time by the eruption of Vesuvius. And so you capture an image of Rome in the height of the reign of Nero. And we all know Nero was this big party boy who loved to go out and drink and make merry. So you get this very clear snapshot of then. After Nero, you get this swing back into very conservative values with emperors like Vespasian. And so we tend to form our views of Rome on this very very singular entity. Whereas if you look at Rome in preceding or following centuries, it's actually pretty conservative. And America does the same thing. It swings back and forth between being relatively liberal and being relatively conservative.
Interesting. All right, guys, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate you spreading the word about the Alamo. It's something that we hold near and dear as guys who took Texas history in, what was it, 7th or 8th grade. And so thank you for dispelling myths and also just getting people encouraged to go over to the Alamo while they're here in San Antonio this week. Really appreciate it, fellas.
Thanks for having us on.
God bless Texas.
No doubt. God bless Texas. All right, there they go. Very nice. And Tom Harper. And Dr. Bruce Winders.
Yes, Dr.
Sir.
Bruce Winders, yes. Thank you very much, guys. We're live from Westwood One's NCAA Final Four Radio Row, and it's brought to you by Country Inn and Suites by Radisson. When you're on the road to cheer for your team or visit family, Country Inn and Suites by Radisson is the next best thing to home. Find a location at countryinn.com. Coming up more on Midday with Trey and BK, including we're speaking with Brad Underwood at 10:50. You're listening to The Horn. Back here on the Midday Show, live from Westwood One's NCAA Final Four Radio Row, and it's brought to you by Werner, the official ladder of NCAA March Madness and the official ladder of professional contractors everywhere. Werner, number one in ladders, and no Bucky Godbolt. Quit blowing BK and my phones up. We're not having Davy Crockett on their airwaves in the next couple of segments. Those guys are really good dudes, and they're spreading the word about the Alamo. We have no problem talking to those guys.
Yeah, no doubt, but we do have a guy who's not part of that San Antonio history, but trying to make some history nowadays in San Antonio, the head coach of the UTSA Roadrunners, Steve Henson, joing us right now. Coach, how you doing today?
Doing great. Good to be here.
Now, you've been at UTSA for 2 years so far as the head man and a very successful year at Conference USA Coach of the Year. How has the tenure been through 2 years down in San Antonio?
Well, it's been fantastic. It's pretty much been what we'd hoped it would be. You know, we knew we had a great opportunity. Other coaches looked at this job and felt like we were sitting on a gold mine, and we hoped the recruits would feel like we had something special, and they have. The response has been very, very good. We inherited a group of kids that were very, very hungry. They bought into what we were trying to do. We brought in some kids that helped us, you know, establish our culture in year one. We were tough. We defended. We rebounded. Couldn't make a shot to save our lives in year one. So not real smart, but recognized we better go find some guys that could shoot the ball. So we brought in some guys that had terrific years for us this year. Had a freshman of the year in the league, sixth man of the year, guys that could really score the ball. So, progress has been good. It's been what we hoped it would be, and we got a lot of guys back.
And it has been progress, 14-19 in year one, 20-15 in year two. And you just talked about some of the keys and you guys doing better in this season. You are a point guard. You set records at Kansas State. You played in the NBA for a number of years at the point guard position. What is it that you guys are trying to do on offense?
Well, in year one, we were just trying to survive, and we really struggled so badly to shoot the ball. But that still helped us in the big picture, just helped us create an identity. You know, we got to be tough. We got to rebound, and we did that in year one. But this last year, we played much more up-tempo. We shot a lot of threes. We were one of the fastest tempo teams in the country. So we were running and shooting it freely. Defended very well as the season went on. We improved in that area. I think we're poised now in year three to be good on both ends of the floor. I really do.
There is a philosophy in basketball, and really college basketball especially, that seems to be evolving into one that believes that the mid-range jumper is a little bit of a waste of time. You mentioned that you guys are shooting more threes, trying to get up and down the court. Does your team still value the mid-range game, or do you realize that you either need to be taking shots close to the basket or behind the three-point line?
Yeah, the driving it hard, getting to the rim, you know, attacking, shooting layups. We're not athletic enough to drive it and get a lot of dunks, but getting to the rim and then driving and kicking, shooting threes is really the way, yeah, so many people are playing. If you've got a dominant big guy that can score on the block and get fouled, that's one thing, but there aren't many of those guys out there. And the risk-reward of throwing that ball inside is pretty tough right now. So yeah, we're going to shoot the ball from the three-point line.
Coach, tell us about your point guard, and pardon me if I botch the name. I don't have the Puerto Rican names. I don't even want to try at this point. I'm just going to say Jackson. I'm going to go with Jackson.
Okay.
Led the team in scoring this year, had a season-ending injury down the stretch, which really hurt you guys in the latter couple of weeks. But, man, you got to be excited about having this kid coming back for a few more years.
Yeah, you avoided saying our Italian's name. His name is even harder.
I'm avoiding all the names.
Yeah.
I can go with Steve Henson.
There you
go. I can do that. That's it.
Javon Jackson came in here, and he was a guy that scored at an incredibly high rate in high school in the Dallas area. We knew he could come in and fill some holes for us, and he did that. He came in, had some monster games, put the ball in the hole for us, got a lot of it on his own. He can create his own shot, gets to the foul line a lot, had a very, very good freshman year. Tore his ACL with about two games left in the regular season, but still won the freshman of the year in the league, averaged close to 20 points a game, really, really helped us out. Giovanni De Nicolau, our Italian point guard, has started every single game for 2 years, so both those guys were very, very good. Keaton Wallace is another smaller guard that can play both spots, so we're in great shape at the point and the off-guard position.
Now, you are clearly you're getting a handle on the head coaching thing. You guys had a very nice progression from year one or year two to year two. What is maybe the biggest challenge that you didn't quite understand in stepping into your first head coaching gig here a couple years ago?
That's a great question. You know, you think you're prepared. You know, I learned from the best. Coach Kruger was my mentor. I was around him for over 30 years, actually, as a player and a coach. So I've been around him and watched him do things, how he handled things off the court. Obviously, the great X's and O's guy. So I thought I was ready, and I knew there were some areas that I didn't have experience in, just the day-to-day budget, those types of things. Scheduling. Scheduling is a huge issue at every level. The elite programs are trying to improve their RPI for seeding. Mid-majors are trying to position themselves for at-large bids. Scheduling is a huge aspect of the program that I needed to learn a lot. APR. You know, people don't understand how important that is. You can't go in and turn a program around without affecting your APR. And if you don't handle that the right way, you're going to put your program in jeopardy. So the APR has been a real learning experience for me.
No doubt. And, Coach, I've got to ask, you know, you being in the Sun Belt, look, Middle Tennessee State, I told you I'd use a different word, but I'm going to say the same word. They got shafted this year by the selection.
Conference USA, not Sun Belt.
Absolutely. Conference USA. I'm looking right at it. CUSA, of course. And, look, they had a hell of a year. We've seen them win tournament games in the past. And yet they don't win the conference tournament, the CUSA tournament, and they get left out by the selection committee. Does it feel like college hoops has changed to where the little guy, just unless they get that automatic bid, it's almost like they don't have a chance anymore to make the NCAA tournament?
It's moving in that direction very, very rapidly, and that's the topic of conversation, the entire topic at our league meetings. I've been here 2 years, so I got the job in time to get to that league meeting in year one, and we'll go down there again in about a month, and I'm sure that's what we'll be talking about again, is how do we position ourselves to protect somebody at the top of our league who has a great year. If they don't win a conference tournament, we got to get that at-large bid. And there's a lot of factors to it. The biggest factor is the Power Fives just aren't scheduling people. They won't leave home in the non-conference.
Right.
So we have to figure out how do we make our adjustments and protect. We have to win more non-conference games. We have to schedule wisely. Our league has to be on the same page. We need to partner up with some other similar leagues and get some games lined up that we can elevate the status of the RPI and the standing of our league. And year before, Middle Tennessee did everything right. And they went on the road, beat SEC teams, scheduled aggressively, scheduled wisely. If they had not won the conference tournament the year before, they probably would have got left out as well. So it's something we really, really need to take a look at.
Now, the NCAA is also considering easing up the transfer rule, which in my mind is going to create more of a muddled mess in terms of people trying to follow the sport itself. You as a mid-major, I'm assuming that you're opposed to that rule that makes it easier for guys to transfer and play immediately at larger schools.
It's a huge topic right now. It's a very really tough situation. I mean, you can look at so many different sides that our coaches leave all the time. You know, they get another opportunity, they move on, and they don't have to sit out a year. So I understand that argument. A lot of the mid-majors are losing their best player. They're being poached. The other thing people don't consider is think about how stressful the recruiting process is for a kid one time. Now he goes somewhere as a freshman, and it never ends. I mean, if it's open transfer rules, those kids are going to be recruited nonstop, and they'll be miserable the entire time. I mean, they need to, once they get there, they need to be able to relax and buy in and enjoy the process. And that's another concern that I don't think people are looking at, but there's a lot of different factors to it.
Coach, we appreciate the time, sir. Thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck moving forward. And we got a lot of UTSA fans back in Austin, so hopefully when the season starts next year, we can maybe do this again soon.
That'd be great. Thanks for having me. Enjoy San Antonio.
Thank you, sir. There you go. Steve Henson, head coach of UTSA. The Roadrunners are a pretty solid year in year two. Steve Henson getting things done. The Kansas native, McPherson, Kansas. Junction City, Kansas, joining us for a few minutes. And we're going from coach to coach here right now, as we'll extend a little bit into the top of the hour. But a lot of fun conversation right there. We're going from one Kansas State alumnus to another alumnus of Kansas State. We've got Illinois head coach Brad Underwood joining us right now. Coach, thanks so much for the time today, sir. How you doing?
I'm doing great. So I just heard you bring up McPherson, Kansas.
Yes, sir. I'm an Overland Park guy originally.
You know, that's where I'm from. So,
yes, sir. Absolutely.
So how about having two bull pups
there
set back to back?
And I'm from Garden City, Kansas, guys. So it's three Kansas guys at a table. I'm not really from Garden City, Coach. I apologize for lying to you like that.
Coach, how was year one up in Illinois this year? Champagne, everything you could have imagined?
Unbelievable job.
Okay.
It's an unbelievable job. It's a great place. It's one of the elite, in my opinion, it's one of the elite college towns and universities in the country. I think a year ago at this time it was considered the 11th best program in the history of college basketball, and it is all of that, and yet we've slipped. So you know, we were very, very young. We were one of the 20 youngest teams in the country, and you know, maybe didn't go as well as we had hoped on the court, but it was a year of growth, and a lot of freshmen got a lot of minutes and a lot of time, and we survived, and now we're, you know, it's a process, and we had to go through this process to continue to build the program.
Ever since you hit the ground as a head coach, you've experienced a lot of success. Last year was your first below 500 season as a head coach. What is the biggest challenge with that in terms of getting things righted and getting it back to not just over 500 basketball, but over 20 wins in a season at Illinois?
Well, I think the one thing is, you know, you have to understand what you're coming into, and I don't want to say temper expectations. I thought we could have been. We were so close. We lost four overtime games. We lost one at the buzzer, and all of a sudden things go a little bit different, and you ride that wave of confidence, and you're in. But I knew it was a process, and I think that. You understand what you have to do. I'm sticking to my guns. I know what we do works. I've been able to witness that and experience that, and now I've got to translate that to our young guys. Everything else, I say this many times, we're a ticking time bomb in terms of the fuse has been lit. We've got passionate fans. We've got a beautiful, beautiful arena. And a wonderful university. And when you get that combination and you've got a tremendous administrator and Josh Whitman, our athletic director, you've got a chance. And coaches don't win championships. Administrations win championships. So we've got a fighting chance.
Coach, we've got to ask, you just mentioned translating the message to your young guys. I got to ask you about one of your young guys, Trent Frazier, the point guard, second on the team in scoring this year. The dude is fun to watch. I enjoyed watching him play throughout the year. Tell us a little bit about his game. Do you expect him to be one of the team leaders over the next couple of years?
Yeah, he's really developed into that this year, and it was challenging. I'm proud of him because we played two conference games in early December. Trent hardly played in those games, and he wasn't ready. And then he stepped into his role, and he became that guy. And You know, we were not a team. We struggled shooting the ball from the perimeter, so the lane became very clogged for him. But he's got tremendous speed, tremendous quickness. He's a natural scorer. He does it in a lot of different ways. He's probably as good a mid-range game as anybody in the country. And yet he's still just his ceiling is so high. And so I'm excited about him. I think he can be a guy that not just is a proven player on the court, but I think he'll be a proven guy in our locker room.
We just asked Steve Henson about this, and he said, look, our team is a drive and dish team now, and we don't shoot a whole lot of mid-range jumpers. Is the mid-range jumper a waste of a shot on your team?
No, I think it's a great piece to have. I think it's a hard shot. You know, we were number one in the country a year ago at Oklahoma State in offensive efficiency, and our philosophy was to score in the first 7 seconds. We averaged 86 points a game, and you do that with threes, layups, and free throws. And we were down this year. We averaged 74 a game, but it was up from the 61 the year before. So, you know, I think the one thing we're trying to do is increase our ability to shoot the basketball. Our best shooter was our five man. This year, you look at the four teams in the Final Four, and they're all basically four out, one in. They play one big, and most of the bigs, Villanova's case, Michigan's case, Kansas is probably the only team, and I guess Loyola to an extent, their five man doesn't pop out shoot threes, but right. The rest of those guys are great 3-point shooters. So the game's very much about passing and shooting. Loyola is the best passing team, in my opinion, in the country.
Beautiful spacing.
And when you can pass, you have IQ and you have a feel, and that's the way the game's going today.
Coach, in Big 12 country, I've got to ask a question you've been asked probably 200 million times over the past calendar year or so. But you took Oklahoma State to an incredible year, your only year there. What drew you to the Illinois job after it looked like you had things going in the right direction up in Stillwater?
Well, people forget I spent 10 years when I was young in my coaching days in the state of Illinois. And Illinois was so powerful. It's a basketball state. High school basketball is very, very dominant. And the little town shut down. And the state tournaments is such a big deal. And it thrives there. It's such a source of pride for everybody in the state. So the one thing that I remember is the power of that. They were rolling. Illinois was rolling, and Lon Kruger had it going, and Bill Self followed it up, and Bruce came in and led them to a Final Four in 2005, and I remember that. And Oklahoma State's a place I thought I would end my career, and yet Illinois's been a spot that I've always revered and had tremendous respect for, and when the opportunity came, I thought it was just a tremendous one.
Coach, I'll tell you what, you're doing a hell of a job on CBS, man. Seeing your face breaking down all these games, is this the next step in your career? I'm sure you want to coach for a long time, but when you hang them up, if you will, is becoming a broadcaster or an analyst something you've always wanted to do?
It's my degree, to be honest. I'm a radio TV
Makes
major.
Sense. You're good at it.
I was told that I had a face for radio, and
my mom told me the same thing growing up.
But if you're not going to be in the tournament, it's really a good place to be. And I enjoyed, you know, the three networks or four networks, and being able to watch all the games and break them down, and it was fun. I had a great time, Candace and Seth and all those guys were fabulous. So we had a great couple days.
You're doing a great job, yeah. Coach. Really appreciate not just the covers, but also the coaching job that you've done here in the state of Texas, especially with SFA a couple years ago, then Oklahoma State, now with Illinois. Best of luck in the broadcasting, also the coaching career.
I appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much, Coach. There he goes, another Kansas native, Kansas Stater, Brad Underwood, getting it done. We appreciate his time, and there he goes. All right. We are taking a break. We're overdue for it, but hey, we're live on Radio Row, and Westwood One's NCAA Final Four Radio Row has been brought to you by Boost Mobile. With Boost Mobile, you can get four lines for only $25 per line, each with unlimited gigs, plus get up to four free Samsung J7 perks and 6 months of Hulu, all taken care of with our friends at Boost Mobile. All right, so what a segment that was. Talking to Steve Henson, talking to Brad Underwood, talking some Alamo.
Just 1 hour.
Just 1 hour in. Two more hours to go. We are live at Radio Row down in San Antonio for the Final Four. You're listening to Midday with Trey and BK. This is The Horn.